Ladies and gentlemen, citizens of the world.
Ladies and gentlemen, get ready.
Please give it up.
This is Rihanna.
It's Rihanna.
Rihanna Patrick.
ABC Radio.
Hi, I'm Rihanna Patrick, and thanks for downloading this ABC Re podcast. Dr. Craig Barker from the University of Sydney is giving you an update of all the latest events and news from the archaeology world.
One of the most significant archaeological sites in the entire Middle East, the World Heritage listed site at Palmyra, which of course had been quite heavily featured in the mainstream media over the past couple of years because it was taken by militants from ISIS in May of 2015, and they held on to the archaeological site in the modern town of Palmyra up until March of last year. And during that time, it caused massive destruction. They destroyed the Temple of Bel at the site, the Roman Arch of Victory, and perhaps most infamously murdered the very well-regarded and world-renowned Syrian archaeologist Khalid al-Assad. There was much celebration in March of last year when Syrian government forces, backed by the Russians, retook Palmyra, both the modern town and the archaeological site. Pardon me. And some of our listeners may actually remember some of that amazing drone footage at the time of drones flying over the ruins of the World Heritage listed site, and of course the fact that there was actually a concert held in the Roman Theatre by an orchestra from St. Petersburg. So it was one of those sites that I think that many people had thought, well, you know, it's been retaken, it is safe from vandalism from ISIS. But the bad news is that in December last year, just before Christmas, the militant group retook the archaeological site and still continue to hold it today. So, again, it's indicative of how many of these very, very significant archaeological sites are being taken backwards and forwards as the borderline and as the front line of fighting shifts both in Iraq and in Syria.
And Craig, it looks as though there might have been some damage to the Roman theatre that's there, which was what you were talking about the St. Petersburg orchestra being there.
Yeah, it became quite symbolic because, of course, ISIS were using the theatre as the point in which they were actually beheading perceived enemies of their reign of terror. And so it's rather sad for a whole set of reasons, but again, quite symbolically in many ways. It's one of those things that sort of information had been leaking out over the past couple of weeks about damage being caused to that particular building on the site and a few other places as well. But satellite images from about 8 days ago have confirmed that the theatre itself, and particularly the proscenium, has been quite badly damaged by the militants, as are the tetrapylons, the four-pillared structures, a couple of hundred metres to the north of where the theatre was. So two of those four-pillared structures have been seemingly completely destroyed, and the other two seem to be quite damaged. It's worthwhile bearing in mind that although it was originally a Roman building, what you see today, or what you did see until the destruction, was predominantly a modern replica made in the early 1960s. So I guess as long as the blocks are remaining, there is the opportunity for it to be rebuilt again in the future. But what you're seeing is this absolute wanton vandalism and complete destruction of cultural heritage.
Craig, we go from the latest at Palmyra to, I mean, you pretty much had me with this with flesh eating, but this is a bit of flesh eating disease and the curse of the monkey god in Honduras.
I wish we had this news story last December when we did horror movies.
Yes.
Because this one was born for it. And I must admit that when I saw the headline, and I know there's much discussion at the moment about fake news and alternative facts and all of those other things as well, but when I read a newspaper headline, "Jungle Explorers Contract Rare Flesh-Eating Disease Amongst Ruins of Ancient Lost City of the Monkey God," the first thing I thought of was you.
Oh, I'm touched. I'm so glad you know me so well.
And it is one of those stories that as you dig deeper, is fictional to some degree, but rather unfortunate that the sensationalised headlines and that focus on the curse of the monkey god and so on is actually hiding a really interesting archaeological discovery in many ways. So I thought it'd be worthwhile having a bit of a chat about it, because we can separate some of the fact from some of the more salacious reporting on it.
what do we know, Craig?
Well, what we do know is that this is in Honduras, in Central America, a city which has been covered by, largely by the jungle, actually, but covered by accumulation of soil over the centuries. But a city that known in Spanish is Ciudad Blanca, the White City, that was occupied approximately 1,000 to 1,500 AD. The Spanish name probably given to the settlement. Again, it's one of those areas that's taken on something of a mythology, but given to the settlement by early Spanish settlers and conquerors in that part of the world, largely because they seemingly used white local limestone for the construction of buildings in the area, so it gave it a real white appearance, so the White City. The project itself, the city itself, has been rediscovered, largely through the result of LIDAR mapping, and we've spoken about LIDAR in the past, and we'll actually mention it's one of the key discoveries of 2016, but this idea of aerial laser mapping, which actually enables us to get a reading of not just buildings that are below the ground, but also buildings that are below jungles and other type of overgrowth as well. So it's a way of actually seeing into the ground. And it's largely being conducted by the Honduras Institute of Anthropology. So it's actually quite a remarkable discovery. But what's happened, of course, is that it's also a settlement that has a site that has sort of all of its own mythology as well, because it was seemingly deserted by the local residents at some point in the 16th century. There's a myth that's been passed down about a cursed disease. Of course, the reality is that they probably deserted the settlement because this is when the Spanish turned up as well. Of course, this myth of the cursed disease has fallen straight into one of the teams that actually has visited the site in 2016, which is a team of American documentary makers and I think a TV crew, actually, being led by a novelist, a guy called Douglas Preston, who is a horror writer as well, and somehow got involved in the Amanda Knox case. Remember that trial in Italy a couple of years ago? So quite an interesting guy in his own right. But it seems to be that the team led by Preston contracted what's known as Leishmanis disease, which is transferred by sandflies and can eat flesh on your face. The parasites migrate to the mucous membranes within the mouth and the nose. So cool. Something that's not pleasant. That's a face-eating disease. The important thing, which is underplayed in all of the news reporting I've seen of this, was, quote-unquote, all the members of the crew survived. So they may have got the disease, but certainly no one seems to have been that badly damaged. And I should point out that the president of Honduras visited the excavations himself suffered no ill effects whatsoever. So I think there's a bit of sensationalisation going on here as well, particularly given that Preston's book, with the title "The Lost City, the Monkey God: A True Story," is being released in a couple of months' time. So we'll get his own words, but I think that there's a little bit hidden behind this. But again, flesh-eating disease, archaeology curses—we love this stuff, don't we, Rihanna?
I do. But Craig, that's something that comes up quite a bit, isn't it? Of those local stories, sometimes made up so that people would stay away from certain areas.
Yeah, and again, you've got a real mixing together of a whole lot of different oral traditions and all sorts of things. But I think, it's worthwhile emphasising again and again and again that, archaeology at its heart is a scientific process, that we are very, very cautious, particularly in the 21st century, not so much in the past, but in the 21st century, in terms of liaising with locals and actually working within communities, as opposed to kind of coming in and the Indiana Jones type looting adventures of the past have long gone. And I think that, again, it's worthwhile emphasising that these curse stories and so on actually hide the truth, which is not what these ancient settlements can do to us, but it's the damage that we're doing to them. But I must say, as an archaeologist, I've never feared flesh-eating disease. I think that I think that war and conflict are far greater damage, or causing far greater damage, as we're just seeing with Palmyra, than any diseases or curses.
Dr. Craig Barker is in for Can You Dig It? He's from the University of Sydney, and he often drops by ABC Re to talk about the latest in archaeological news. And a little later on tonight, we're actually going to take a look at his top 10 list of the most significant finds of 2016. Now, Craig, there's been a couple of digs a little closer to home, and something sort of happening down there in Tasmania.
Down in Tasmania, yeah. We've not spoken much about what's known as historical archaeology, the archaeology of 19th century colonial settlement in this country. And so it's rather interesting that there are two projects on at the moment that have both been in the news. One is a development site, and the other one in Tasmania is a research project conducted by ANU and by the University of Sydney. So this is at Tryabunna in Tasmania, on the east coast of Tasmania, one of the access points across to Moriah Island, which I had the privilege of working there about 20 years ago now, but really one of the most beautiful parts of Australia's countryside you can imagine. And this whole area, including Moriah Island, is all part of the Port Arthur World Heritage listed site as well. So it's incredibly significant in terms of our understanding of colonial Tasmania, and particularly in terms of prisons, and particularly in terms of military relationships. And the excavations, this is the second season. They had a three-week dig, which has just finished up last week, the second season of a planned four-year project. It's led by Dr. Ash Lenton from ANU, and a colleague of mine at Sydney University, Dr. James Flexner. So what's lovely about the dig is that it's a training dig for undergraduate students at both universities. So quite a number of the students that I know are actually down there at the moment. And, you know, it's actually great to sort of see the next generation of Australian archaeologists getting all sorts of access and all sorts of, you know, first-hand experience in field work. The site itself was the barracks that between 1844 and 1851 housed the 51st Regiment, very significant regiment. They actually fought at the Battle of Waterloo before being sent out to Van Diemen's Land. The barracks themselves are going to be redeveloped for tourist accommodation, so it's a really interesting chance for an archaeological investigation during that process of transformation. They've done public tours of the site. They've worked really locally, really closely with the local community. ABC Tasmania has done a lot of stories on them, which is nice to, you know, get that sort of local history flavour. And this season, surprise, surprise, being an Australian historical archaeology dig, they focused on the pub. Very, very important. But I must say,
you can tell a lot from a pub, though.
You can tell a lot from a pub, and indeed there is, you know, all sorts of excavations right across this country of 19th century pubs that have really given incredibly important social history. But I must say, in this particular case, I mean, again, being a barrack and being a regiment, you tend to think of it being, you know, and again, a pub, you think of it very blokey, blokey, blokey. But what they're finding, of course, is a lot of evidence of children's toys and so on. Social history, evidence of the wives and the children who were living with the military officers while they were on service as well. And so it's a real insight into what life was like, you know, on the other end of the world for English soldiers in the 1840s.
And Craig, we've had a bit of a dig here in Brisbane, which is along sort of similar lines. But what have the archaeologists been looking at in particular when it comes to this Brisbane dig?
Well, this is all part of the Queen's Wharf Casino redevelopment around George Street in Brisbane. And of course, you would know more about the area than I do. You've got the Harris Terraces that were constructed in 1865, largely to house parliamentarians in the relatively recently established at that point in time Queensland Parliament, and others that were associated with Queensland Parliament. So quite an important building historically in terms of Brisbane's history and Queensland's history. But the buildings themselves, of course, are going to be part of the whole redevelopment for the casino is to have these heritage architecture facading the more modern building to the back. So there's a number of test pits that have been excavated over the past couple of weeks, 1 to 3 metres deep. Again, in terms of fines, well, certainly in terms of what's been released to the media, there might have been more done recently, but fines themselves, nothing particularly unsurprising in terms of that type of context. But what it's a lovely example of is this concept of 21st century engineering being used on 18th century buildings, and you know, ways of not just preserving and maintaining heritage architecture from the 19th century, but incorporating it into 21st century buildings and 21st century developments as well. So it's proof that heritage doesn't need to prevent ongoing development, but can actually be part of the ongoing story as well. So it'd be interesting to sort of see, as that, I believe the casino's got years and years and years before it's actually open. So it'd be interesting to see what other types of developments take place along that area.
I'm Rhianna Patrick here with you on ABC Radio, and Craig Barker, Dr. Craig Barker, I should say, from the University of Sydney is in for Can You Dig It, which is where we take a look at the latest archaeological news, events, exhibitions. Craig, there's been a bit happening when it comes to exhibitions, and you've got a few across the world, in case any of us might be travelling, of a few that we should probably check out.
Yeah, it's for anyone lucky enough to be getting on an aeroplane. A couple on in Athens at the moment, and if you can bear the cold, some friends of mine in Athens had some wonderful photos on social media a couple of weeks ago of the snow on the Acropolis, and it looks stunning. But one of my favourite museums in the world, the Museum of Cycladic Art in Athens, is actually celebrating its 30th anniversary. And they've got an exhibition on at the moment. I mean, it's worthwhile seeing any time, but an exhibition called Cycladic Society 5,000 Years Ago. And what it's doing is it's showing the vibrancy of life on the islands in the Aegean, the Cycladic Islands in the Aegean, in the early Bronze Age. And in particular, the fantastic Cycladic figurines, these beautifully stylized, abstract human forms that we still to this day don't really know why they were making them, but made from local marble, cut down with emery from the island of Naxos. So again, demonstrable of incredibly sophisticated trade networks between the different islands over 5,000 years ago. But this incredibly stylized art, it's rather interesting that the influence it had on modernist art in the 20th century. Someone like Pablo Picasso actually collected some of these Cycladic figurines. So they're so old yet so new at the same time. So a wonderful exhibition. And the other one in Athens is at the Acropolis Museum, where it's a rare chance to see an exhibition of a marble bust of the Roman Emperor Hadrian, found in Athens a number of years ago. 2017 is the 1,900th anniversary of Hadrian's ascent to power. And he, of course, went on to become one of the great Roman emperors, a very complicated figure for all sorts of reasons, but... and I believe we're hopefully going to talk about him in one of our future discussions, but a really exciting chance to see one of 175 surviving busts of Hadrian. So he certainly liked posing for his portrait, but this one in Athens at the Acropolis Museum, a rare chance to see it up close.
And some interesting things happening in the US as well, at the University of Michigan.
Yeah, at the Kelsey Museum, one of the great university museums of the world. The University of Michigan has an exhibition called The Art and Science of Healing, from Antiquity to the Renaissance. So for anyone who is interested in medical history, and I suspect anyone with a strong stomach for that matter as well, a great chance to see some of the amazing items in the University of Michigan's collection. The Kelsey Museum itself, later on in the year, will actually host an exhibition celebrating 200 years of the University of Michigan being involved in archaeological excavations around the globe as well, which is an extraordinary legacy. And it is one of the great archaeology museums of one of the great archaeology university museums of the world.
Craig, one that I found, which I was like, oh, if only I was in Sydney, this would be awesome to go to, the Museum of Applied Arts and Sciences, I think formerly the Powerhouse Museum in Sydney, the Egyptian Mummies Exploring Ancient Lives, on now until the end of April. Some great talks are coming up, and I understand that you might be doing one as well.
Yeah, I'm doing one on the 22nd of April on mummy movies, so kind of continuing on from what we talked about on our program last month. But I suggest listeners go and actually listen to some of the great Egyptologists from Macquarie University who are speaking on weekends at other times. So I think the program's on their website. But this is a travelling exhibition from the British Museum. Sydney is the first stop. It actually began its life as a British Museum exhibition a number of years ago called Ancient Lives. This is a slightly different version of it, which will travel around to other institutions around the globe. So Australia's very lucky to sort of be the first cab off the rank. It features six mummies from the British Museum collections and a series of 3D CT scans and other medical investigations of those mummies. And what you get is a chance to explore the whole process of mummification, which of course is something which most people are interested in, but people don't necessarily know the processes and certainly the sophisticated ways that the embalmers would actually engage with the deceased bodies in terms of preparing them for the afterlife. And what's remarkable, of course, is the British Museum having such a massive collection of mummies, is that the curators who have actually selected the mummies for these intensive medical and forensic investigations for the exhibition have them from different time periods throughout Egyptian history. So you actually get to see the changes that take place in terms of the differences in terms of social status, but also chronological differences through time in terms of the way that the embalmers treated the bodies. So it's a really, really fascinating exploration of the whole process of mummification and you know, the way that Egyptians actually revered the dead.
My favourite mummy or mummification of a particular thing in the British Museum is the mummified baboon.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
That is one of my favourites. I've never seen a mummified baboon, but that was hands down one of the most awesome things I've seen.
Well, I mean, the Cairo Museum, of course, also has a mummified hippopotamus.
Oh, that would be...
which is extraordinary.
But that would take so much to do.
I know. And I mean, you know, there are thousands of cat mummies and there are thousands of mummies of the ibis. But it actually shows that in terms of the way it's being practiced, that it's not just humans, but a whole series of animal mummies as well.
And the Australian National Maritime Museum in Sydney in March has got a pretty interesting exhibition coming up.
Yeah, a bit of a teaser for one coming up for Sydneysiders or people coming to Sydney. The Australian National Maritime Museum's Escape from Pompeii exhibition, which is really focusing on the story of the Roman Navy. I mean, everyone knows the story of Volcano Day and everyone knows the story of Pompeii. But, of course, Pompeii was a maritime port, an incredibly important fishing port and a significant producer of garum, Roman fish sauce, which would have tasted absolutely foul for modern taste, but was a delicacy for the Romans. So that engagement with between the citizens of Pompeii and Herculaneum and the sea is going to be explored. And, of course, in the Bay of Naples, which Pompeii was on the coastline of, you have Misenum, one of the most significant Roman naval bases throughout the entire history of the Roman Empire. So this will actually explore Roman maritime engagement, Roman naval engagement. For someone like me who's an amphora buff, I know where I'm going to be going to immediately when the exhibition opens. But it has all sorts of quite remarkable objects from the Naples Archaeological Museum from excavations at Pompeii and Herculaneum. So anyone interested in Pompeii, and particularly for school students and undergraduates who are studying Pompeii, which I know there are thousands of them out there, this will actually be a wonderful chance to see firsthand some remarkable objects.
And just quickly, Craig, we were tweeted by Dr. Hugh, who wanted to let us know about a pretty interesting yes. project he's got going on, which is all on UAV infrared mapping of archaeological sites in Greece. And he reckons this is a great time to talk about crowdfunding archaeology projects.
He would. This is a friend and colleague of mine, Dr. Hugh Thomas, putting his nose in where he shouldn't. But what's fascinating is, of course, that so many of us in the archaeological community are turning to alternative funding methods, as indeed are all of the sciences and all of the academic humanities. And I think that's actually a great opportunity for us to engage with the public, that it's not just a relationship of us begging for cash, but a chance for us to actually share our research. So what Hugh's involved in, and if anyone would like to contribute or find out more about his project, it's on experiment.com/ Zagora. Zagora is an archaeological site in Greece on the Cycladic island of Andros, actually, where the University of Sydney worked in the 1960s and early 1970s, again, has been working over the past couple of years. Hugh is fundraising for an unmanned aerial vehicle infrared mapping project of various archaeological sites in Greece. So an opportunity to actually use drones and other unmanned aerial vehicles to take infrared images of archaeological sites and then actually using that visualization to create 3D models of archaeological sites. And Zagora, Z-A-G-O-R-A, this site that Sydney University has been investigating on and off for decades now, will be one of the major components of his visualization project. So it's a really great chance for people to see firsthand and contribute if they'd like to that type of research as well.